Hi, it's Patrick here, and I'm joined today by a very special guest. In fact, an entire crew, a Boston Road crew, complete with the most unbelievably noisy, shuddering machines, repaving the road right outside the studio. It's really a lot of fun here. Well, onward with the pod. And imagine that you're a kid, born somewhere in Mexico, and then in your infancy, you're brought to the United States by your family, illegally most likely, but possibly on a visa. You go to an American school, you learn English, you lose some of your Spanish. Then, a few years later, you're back south of the border, either because your family has been deported or because they overstayed their visas and they've left out of fear of deportation. At your new Mexican school, you discover that your Spanish, at least your written, your academic Spanish, is shot. Life pretty much sucks.
I was so depressed. I didn't want to go into classes. I didn't want to eat. I didn't even want to talk to my mom. I just wanted to go back.
In the pod today, we'll hear that this is a far from unique story. There's lots of kids flipping between languages and cultures, but also that the Spanish does eventually come back. We have a report today about the words that people use to describe those who enter the U.S. without papers. And there are many, many ways to describe them. Plus, special relationship silliness. And it's a speaking plane. No, it's a speaking bird. No, it's a super injunction.
As a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
I'm here with Patrick, and it's time to talk words. Rawr. New words, old words, censoring everything.
As you know by now, the World in Words podcast and the World Radio program, The Big Show, they're both co-productions of the BBC World Service Public Radio International and WGBH radio station in Boston. Online, we're at theworld.org. To find this podcast, go to theworld.org/language. You can find my blog posts at patrickcox.wordpress.com. And you can follow me on Twitter or Facebook. My handle on Twitter is Patrick Cox, P-A-T-R-I-C-O-X. So today we got a couple of border-related hits. First, deported Mexicans relearning Spanish. Then the various names, both common and uncommon, that people use to describe illegal border crossers. Then super injunction fun in the UK. A super injunction is a kind of injunction plus. Not only are the news media prohibited from talking about a particular subject, but they're also prohibited from saying that they are prohibited from talking about that subject. Doesn't sound very free speech friendly, does it? Well, the problem is, from the point of view of those who seek these injunctions, is that in the age of Twitter, these injunctions just don't work. You can't keep the secret in the bag. And finally, in the pod today, we have a little thing on Obama and Britain, a love story. Does Obama heart Britain more than Britain hearts Obama? Okay, first to the Mexican state of Sonora, which is just south of Arizona. And when Arizona enacted its immigration bill last summer, you know, that very controversial thing that we've talked about actually in previous pods, schools in Sonora, guess what, saw a huge surge in enrollment. Some of the kids were born in the United States. They were U.S. citizens. It's just that their parents weren't. Some of the kids were born in Mexico and had been brought north at a very early age. And many of these kids enrolling in schools in Sonora, they couldn't read or write, and some of them even couldn't speak Spanish. So schools in Sonora are now faced with a problem all too familiar to many American school districts: how to educate students who don't speak the mother tongue and who don't know the culture. This and the next story, by the way, come to us from the Fronteras desk at station KJZZ. Devin Brown reports this one from Nogales, Mexico.
Fidal Avalos is the only 16-year-old at the 38th Secundaria School in Nogales, Mexico, who speaks with a southern twang.
Like I said, my English is better than my Spanish.
Fidal was born in Mexico, but raised in Raleigh, North Carolina. He grew up listening to his mom speak Spanish, but he always answered her in English, and he never learned to read or write in Spanish. So when he started school in Mexico last fall, he was lost.
Yeah, so I had problems with that. I struggled with the words, like the homeworks and everything that they give me, because it's in Spanish.
This was a problem not only for Fidal. Sonora's Department of Education reports that the number of migrant school kids from the U.S. has gone up by nearly 25% in the past year. Their families returned mostly because of the lagging American economy and rising fears of deportation. There are now about 9,000 of these students in Sonora, all with varying levels of Spanish. And many teachers don't know what to do with them, says Sandra Hernandez. She's a superintendent of schools in Nogales.
They say, what am I going to do if he doesn't understand Spanish? Okay, don't be afraid. We can work with him because he's only one, two, or three per class.
The numbers are still small compared to the numbers of Spanish-speaking students in, say, Arizona or California. In Sonora, these English-speaking kids have the advantage of true immersion. They're in homes with families who speak Spanish and in neighborhoods where everything is in Spanish, says Hernandez.
When a kid comes from the United States, they learn so fast Spanish, believe me.
But not fast enough, says Fidel Avalos. He finds learning to read and write academic Spanish hard, and adapting to the culture even harder.
When I had just got here, I was so depressed. I didn't want to go into classes. I didn't want to eat. I didn't even want to talk to my mom. I just wanted to go back.
Sonora's Department of Education recently surveyed the new migrant students and found that many of them are unhappy here. 80% said they want to go back to the United States. So in March, the department piloted a new support program for them. The department's Jesus Ramirez Cordova says many of these students are in Mexico against their will. If their parents weren't deported, they often fled the states out of the fear that they would be.
They were changed from one place to another place without being asked. Yeah, their parents just got them, brought them over, or maybe their parents were also brought over without asking them. And that made them feel not very good, not very well.
Fidel is unusual. He came here voluntarily because he wanted to know more about where he was born. But he says it's tough to fit in. He and another migrant student, Marcos Torres, say the kids here tease them about their music, their clothes, and their Justin Bieber haircuts.
Yeah, they told us to stop wearing skinny jeans.
People here tease you because they call you gringo and stuff like that.
They act like if we weren't Mexicans like them.
And Fidel says he's not like them. He likes football and fried chicken. He's too American. Now he just wants to go back to North Carolina, the place he says he's really from.
Yeah, I came here and I've seen what it's like, and I just want to go back and not come back here.
Fidel's recently applied to renew his visa so that he can go back to Raleigh and live with his uncle while he finishes high school. His application is still pending. For The World, I'm Devin Brown in Nogales, Mexico.
Okay, staying in this neck of the woods, the U.S.-Mexico border, the following is a piece about the various words we use to describe illegal immigrants. Of course, the choice of words often has a lot to do with our views on immigration, both legal and illegal. Reporting this one is Michelle Marisco. And by the way, some of the language you'll hear is potentially offensive. No swear words or anything, just insulting. Here goes.
Illegal immigrant.
You're an illegal immigrant.
They're illegals.
Border hoppers. Mojados.
Illegal aliens.
Them are illegal immigrants, wetbacks.
Undocumented citizens.
Undocumented workers.
Undocumented person in this country.
The answers go on and on. They change from one person to the next. An Oklahoma judge had to apologize recently for calling his roofers wetbacks. When the United States deported 1 million illegal immigrants 55 years ago, few blanched at Operation Wetback. Nowadays, that term is unacceptable. People in Arizona can't even decide what to call their kids. Arizona's having a debate about U.S.-born children of illegal immigrants. That's led to a debate about the term anchor babies, which is used to describe those children.
Everything from those folks to border crossers to illegal border crossers. I sort of like the word alambristas. That suits me.
That's Jim Griffith. He's an old Tucson folklorist. I have to look up the word. Alambristas, wire jumpers.
Every label for a group of people can be so politically charged. And one of the things we're suffering from is that this particular group of people does not have a formal voice.
Many journalists use illegal border crosser or even illegal entrant. In a story I wrote for a Southwest magazine, the editor went with, quote, immigrant worker smugglers. We even disagree here at the Fronteras Changing America desk. Some reporters go with undocumented immigrant, others illegal migrant, or illegal immigrant. The government prefers to use illegal aliens.
Our policy is to use the term illegal alien, and that is because we find that that term most accurately reflects the definitions contained in the Immigration and Nationality Act.
That's Vincent Picard. He's a spokesman for Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Arizona. ICE agents use UDAs, short for undocumented alien, but not in public.
In any bureaucratic organization, or I think pretty much any organization, employees often have different terms or perhaps use shorthand to refer.
It's not just the illegal border cross, illegal immigrants. We throw labels on everybody involved along the border. Anna Alonzo is an assistant professor in anthropology at the University of Arizona.
I don't just see it on the right. I also see it on the left when ranchers who have legitimate grievances are simply dismissed as racist.
Whatever we use, racists, anchor babies, wetbacks, mojados, undocumented immigrants, they're all phrases that color the issue.
They obscure the real problem, and so we get no further.
As a reporter, figuring out what to call people who are in the U.S. illegally has been a challenge. I've decided to stick with one of three terms: illegal, undocumented, or unauthorized migrant. In San Diego, I'm Michel Marisco.
Okay, now on to super injunctions. And as I said before, when you have a super injunction in place, the press is not allowed not only not to report on a certain topic, they can't even say that the super injunction exists, that they're not allowed to report on it. And that has helped in the past a lot of rich and famous people keeping their names out of the papers, especially the tabloids. The latest case involves an extremely well-known soccer player, footballer, and his alleged affair. The player got the courts to issue a gag order on the story, but Twitter users took matters into their own hands, as Twitter users do. And of course, if they're outside the UK, what can you do about it? Twitter's all over the world. You can tweet. You're not subject to any kind of injunction handed down by the British courts. In any case, there were tens of thousands of tweets, if not more, naming this player. He was named over and over and over again. It was the most open secret in the history of open secrets. But then the guy got named officially in the British Parliament. Well, we asked London correspondent Laura Lynch to do a story for The Big Show on the day that happened.
This afternoon, the legal silence over the identity of the famous soccer star was shattered. It took a calculated act of defiance in Parliament to do it. A member of the House of Commons, John Hemming, used the cloak of parliamentary privilege to name names despite a court order not to.
With about 75,000 people having named Ryan Giggs on Twitter, it's obviously impracticable to imprison them all.
Ryan Giggs, many in the US have probably never heard of him. But the 37-year-old is a star over here, a star who didn't want to see any stories about an alleged extramarital affair surface in the press. So when the MP spoke Giggs' name, in spite of the gag order, the Speaker of the Commons was quick to slap him down.
Order. Let me just say to the Honourable Gentleman, I know that he's already done it, but occasions such as this, order.
The parliamentary naming of the player is the climax of a frenzied few days. The court injunction meant to suppress his identity instead fed a Twitter-led revolt. Thousands began naming him. After his lawyers asked Twitter to turn over the names of the offending tweeters, the numbers grew even larger. John Whittingdale, who chairs the Commons Media Committee, doubted there's anyone who didn't know who the soccer player is.
That you would virtually have to be living in an igloo not to know the identity of at least one Premier League footballer who has obtained an injunction, and that the articles, that the actions by thousands of people of posting details of this on Twitter are in danger of making the law look an ass.
And that is the serious question at the heart of this story about privacy, press freedom, and gossipy tabloids. The law in England declares both a right to privacy and a right to free expression. But the right to privacy has led to more than one injunction barring the press from naming the famous. Recent cases involve not just the player, but a top bank boss and even a prominent journalist. Lawyer and member of the House of Lords, Helena Kennedy, slams those who claim to be defending press freedom.
Let's be clear. The reason that most of the tabloid press want to write about footballers is about money. This is about the corporate world wanting to make lots of money. The way to sell newspapers is to have this kind of gossip. And so be clear that this is about money. And so when they dress it up as being all about free speech, is it really about that? And when you have MPs standing up and making a song and dance about footballers and about oppression, whose oppression are they talking about? The oppression of somebody on Twitter who just likes engaging with the gossip?
But the gossip has turned into a tense debate about just who can and should decide what the public should and shouldn't know, and whether anyone can even control it in this day and age. It's pitting politicians against each other and the courts, and the famous against not just the press, but those who live in the Twitter sphere. In the midst of all of this, Twitter executives in the U.S. have stayed silent, watching the storm rage all around them. For The World, I'm Laura Lynch, in London.
And by the way, this issue over gag orders and super injunctions, it's not just about public figures like footballers or bankers or broadcasters having affairs. It's corporations too. The most notorious case involved a company called Trafigura, which was accused of dumping toxic waste in Ivory Coast. I think we may have done something on that on a previous pod. Trafigura's lawyers got themselves a super injunction that prohibited The Guardian newspaper from reporting actually on a question that was asked in the British Parliament about this alleged toxic waste dumping. And the injunction was lifted after a few months after, again, Twitter had been used to spread the word unofficially and it had become an open secret again. The British government seems to agree now, after this latest case, that super injunctions just aren't working. Prime Minister David Cameron this week called the current legal situation unsustainable. No secrets, by the way, on this pod. Okay, just in case you missed it, President and Michelle Obama have been doing Europe this week. Ireland, Britain, France, Poland, another day, another country. In Britain, the Obamas stayed at Buckingham Palace, no less. They have, in fact, been firm friends with Queen Elizabeth ever since last year when, do you remember, Michelle Obama and the Queen broke protocol and, well, they're pretty much hugged. But not everyone in Britain is convinced that Barack Obama actually likes them all that much. He doesn't seem to value that somewhat creepy handshake thing known as the special relationship, you know, between the US and Britain. Well, this constellation of facts and fear and decorum was all the excuse I needed to do a trifling little thing for the big show on the special relationship. Here it is. No one ever said love was easy, but it sure seemed easy once upon a time when Britain and America were fighting the Nazis together.
I want to be alone with you, June. Where were you born?
Boston.
Mass?
Yes.
That's a place to be born. History was made there. Are you in love with anybody? No, no, don't answer that.
I could love a man like you, Peter.
I love you, June. Your life, and I'm leaving you.
But in that wartime movie, he didn't leave her. True love prevailed. Today, though, many Brits are fraught with anxiety. Their queen is entertaining Barack Obama, a man greatly admired for his speeches, his style, his personal history. Yet some Brits aren't feeling the love. Not that he won't declare his affection for them over the next couple of days.
Well, of course, that's what he'll say.
This is historian Neil Ferguson.
And I'm sure there's a speech full of well-worn Atlanticist clichés waiting to be delivered from the autocue.
But don't buy into them, says Ferguson.
I think it's no secret that compared with really almost all his predecessors since Franklin Roosevelt, that President Obama is the least Anglophile president for more than a generation.
Don't tell that to fellow historian Simon Sharma.
Look, I don't know how you measure Anglophilia, actually, or whether it's a particularly important quality now.
It's true. Measuring the love of something is problematic. But people in love still do it. They insist on testing their partner's love in strange and inappropriate ways. So let's just try a British way to measure Anglophilia and ask again, does President Obama love the UK?
If it means putting milk in his tea, probably not, actually.
Point taken, Simon Sharma.
I'm always struck, actually, by how touchy us Brits are about this. What was he supposed to do to signify his love? I don't quite know what he's got to do to suggest that he's really as warm and cuddly as his predecessors towards the United Kingdom.
He could go to a cricket match. He could tell the Brits that their food has improved, their teeth too. But that's not exactly pillow talk for two nations supposed to have a special relationship. Ah, yes, that term, the special relationship. It's been rebranded for this presidential trip to the clunkier not just special, but essential. Neil Ferguson isn't having any of it.
The trouble is that the British see this in a completely different way from the Americans. I mean, the British think they're in a special relationship, but the Americans have quite a few special relationships, and I don't think that we're the most special.
Ouch! To make things special again, one of two things may help. One, talk about the French. Or two, sit tight and hope for a big cultural moment that makes the two countries realize how close they really are. Like if Mike Myers finally made another Austin Powers movie. Now there's a guy who loves Britain, warts and all. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox.
I can't believe Vanessa, my bride, my one true love, the woman who taught me the beauty of monogamy, was a fembot all along. Wait a tick. That means I'm single again. Oh, behave! Yeah! Yeah, baby, yeah! Halt!
Okay, I'm out of here. Sounds like the road crew are too. Silence is golden. See you on Facebook and Twitter, and I hope very much that Carol will feature in the next part.